everybody, welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 230. Clipping along here. I cannot believe we've done 230 of these. It's crazy. My name's Cameron English, your host as always, joined by the talented, the thoughtful Dr. Liza Dunn. Liza, you had an exciting weekend. It's funny. I was thinking to myself, I had a great weekend, spent some time with my family, went and saw Oppenheimer, and then I started getting ready for the show. I was like, oh, Liza got married. That tops my weekend.
Yeah, really fun weekend. Yes, we had friends from all the way back to years and years and years. I had friends from seventh grade, friends from college, friends from way, way, way back. So it was fun. A big group of friends and family.
Really, really cool. Well, congratulations again. Very exciting time. Best of luck to you in your future endeavors as a married lady.
Thank you.
Get fun. All right, everyone, let's jump into our stories for the week. We've got three, as always, really interesting stuff, heavy on the public health side. You know, it affects the decisions you make and so on. So let's get into these. So first up, why proposed PFAS chemical bans might do more harm than good. Next up, mushroom hallucinogen sales booming despite reports of serious side effects. And finally, what makes ultra-processed food so unhealthy? Question mark. Brought to you by NPR. We'll get into that last. But first up, let's talk about this. This is a story in Bangor Daily News by David Clement, who is with the Consumer Choice Center, I believe, is the group he's affiliated with. And here he's talking about these lawsuits that have been filed against a manufacturer called 3M. And particularly in this case, they make foam that firefighters use to put out chemical fires and like jet fuel fires and so forth. And these foams contain PFAS, which Liza, as a toxicologist, can explain more about. But the basic idea is these chemicals, when they're used to fight fires, they get into the soil, they get into the water supply, and there are some public health concerns that this could affect, you know, kids drinking water or just, you know, just access to clean, fresh water. So these are the concerns. And of course, our friends, the lawyers, have gotten involved, and there's been some massive lawsuits brought against 3M. And they have recently settled most or all of this litigation for $10.3 billion. It's absolutely crazy. Now, the interesting thing here is that there isn't really a claim that the company did anything nefarious. You know, so if you remember, we talked about Aaron Brockovich last week, everybody, and the claim in that movie and the claim in a lot of these product liability suits is the company made this product. They lied about the dangers that it posed to the public or to children or to innocent bunnies or whatever. And that's the justification for the lawsuit. In this case, 3M made a product that does what it's supposed to do. Municipalities, fire departments bought these foams and used them. And the company is now being sued because of some negative externalities possibly associated with the PFAS chemicals. Now we'll get into that in a minute, but that's the gist of the story. I think that adds a little interesting twist to it. And jump in here, Liza, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that's a really unfortunate because I personally would, if I were ever in an airplane fire, I would like the plane to be put out rapidly. And there are no really good solid links between an adverse health outcome and PFAS exposure. There are associations that have been made by IARC and so the International Agency for Research on Cancer and some high dose animal studies, but the PFAS is, first of all, I want to say between 6,000 and 9,000 different PFASs that are out there on the market, and they have really critical roles in different industries and in different things that we use in everyday life. And so to gin up a whole lot of concern over something that I think actually is useful in saving lives, you don't want to burn up in an airplane fire. I think that has raised a lot of concern in the public about exposure to trace levels and has potential to really have a big, huge impact on your quality of life and everyday things that you use, including medicinal products and including implants, including a whole variety of things that we can get into more details. But anyway, PFAS, what does that stand for? It's polyfluoroalkyl substances. And they're, once again, a whole bunch of them that are used to really, really, reduce friction and to like I said, put out fires. And they're very, very critical in a lot of things that we kind of take for granted as a society.
Yeah, they're in everything. I don't think people realize that. On the medical side, just to give an incomplete list, we're talking about vascular grafts, stent grafts, surgical meshes, catheter tubes and wiring, as well as heart patches. So lots of stuff in here. And he makes the point, Clement makes the point in the article, that a lot of people are walking around with, you know, some sort of implant, some sort of medical device that contains PFAS, and they don't know. And the reason that is because the FDA has looked at this over and over the years and said these are safe to use. It doesn't really cause a problem. And
they've been around 70 years.
Yes.
So very, very long time. Just because you're exposed to a trace amount of something doesn't mean it's going to have an untoward health effect. And that's where people are missing, is that this is very much, part of our everyday existence, but is not going to cause harm at the doses that you're exposed to.
Yes. Let's get a little more specific. I'm pulling this info from some work that was done by another toxicologist I know named Susan Goldhaber. If you just go to acsh.org and type PFAS into the search bar, you'll find all her stuff. Very, very informative because she's an expert and she actually goes into the literature, which very few people do. So one of the things she points out is there are some epidemiological studies, about 8, that will show that pregnant women have higher levels of one particular chemical in this class called PFOA. And if they're exposed to enough of this, there seems to be a link to lower birth weight in their children. And that could be concerning. Again, it's only an association. But then on the other side of the equation, there's 23 other studies that have failed to find the same link. Same thing with cancer, with PFOA specifically. There's been 14 studies. And let's see, yeah, it's only a handful of them that have actually found the association. So in other words, the data are all over the place. This isn't like smoking and lung cancer, where just about every study you look at conclusive is the wrong word for epidemiology, very strongly shows that smoking causes lung cancer. This is not what we're dealing with here. Your thoughts on
that? Yes. Once again, these epidemiologic studies don't, fulfill the, Branson Hill criteria. Bradford Hill criteria. Branson's a town in Missouri that's very fun to go to. But anyway, Bradford Hill criteria. So there's an association that's made, but there is not evidence to back up significant causality. So you don't find at doses that you see in people or levels of people, you're not finding animals coming down with cancer. You're not finding, you know, laboratory evidence of mechanistic ways of these things happening. There are a whole set of rules that take you from just an association. Like we said before, there's been an increase in autism over the past 20 years, and there's also been an increase in organic food consumption. And so that's an association, but it's not causal at all. You can make all of these different kinds of associations for ridiculous things as well. And so that's the problem, is when people are leaping to causality when based on a inconsistent study. And if you look at these studies closely, these epidemiologic studies, they are not they're not really high quality, robust studies.
One other thing we should add is that the EPA sets exposure limits for just about every chemical that you are exposed to in the environment, in your food, in consumer products, and this is what they're supposed to do. Now, something that happens somewhat frequently, and it's very frustrating, is that the EPA, oftentimes responding to political pressure or lobbying from this or that interest, will set standards that are absurd and absurdly low. So in this case, for PFAS, they have set, it's not technically an enforceable level, but it's a guidance. And so if they set this guidance, you have smaller governments, state and local governments, that will set this as the legal threshold for exposure to PFAS in water. And it's so low that it cannot be measured with the tools that we have. Okay. So it's absurd. So in other words, you know, all this freaking out about this chemical, these chemicals in your water, and they can't even measure it. That's how low this is. It's just ridiculous.
That's exactly right. And CDC last year, I actually was talking, we were talking in the medical toxicology community about how to answer questions that people have, because there's so much fear engendered about these things, right? And so they're saying that, quote unquote, this is according to CDC, there is no established PFAS blood level at which a health risk is expected or that predicts health problems. And then also the National Academies have a document, and we can point you to this document if you want, that says research has yet to determine the relationship between exposure to PFAS at a specific level and the health impacts that might occur. So we're doing these huge, we're talking about doing huge interventions on chemicals that are very well understood and very well tested, and have really important, benefits to society, that could actually wind up, one, taking them off the market. And this, once again, we can get into this a little bit more, but that's impacting a whole range of very important chemicals, right? And the very important devices and things like that. Based on an association that's found in epidemiologic literature. And I think that we need to figure out how to start looking at these things more critically so we don't start setting society back for things.
Yeah, it's helpful to point that out, because I think this is a result of trying to settle this in the courts. Because in the courts, the focus is we need to punish the defendant. You know, and in this case, it's 3M. We need to bilk them for billions of dollars. And the money goes to some of it anyways. A lot of it's going to the attorneys, of course, but some of it is going to these various municipalities to test their water and treat their water for PFAS contamination. But none of it's actually going to go to, okay, well, if there is a risk there in these exposures, how do we reduce that risk? Is there a better alternative we can use in these firefighting foams? Those questions are not being addressed in these lawsuits because they're not equipped for that. This is why you have regulatory agencies, deeply flawed that they are. This is why you have scientific institutions and even companies to invest in and develop these sorts of safer products.
But if companies are losing or settling for $10 billion here, $20 billion there, they're not going to take the risk to produce these things. Mm-hmm. Right? It's going to get to a point where it's just not worth the innovation. And so if they stop making these things, we become dependent on other states that aren't necessarily our allies for these things. So I think that, well, we can get into this a little bit later, but we really need to start thinking about having a more robust discussion, and companies, I think, need to start having a more robust discussion about why these things are really important and beneficial. And it shouldn't be just housed on the company's website. Mm-hmm. We need to start getting out and engaging with people and having discussions with people and really, really addressing these things, because I think these have a big negative impact on society.
Yeah, we need to think in terms of trade-offs, as the economist Thomas Sowell would say. You know, there's not, there like a lot of people involved in these kind of discussions, they think in terms of solutions, right? Bad chemical, ban bad chemical, world flourishes. It doesn't work that way, right? These different chemicals, these different products we use, they're used because they are useful for one reason or another, or multiple reasons. And so you can't just say, well, we'll get rid of it and everything will be fine. Life's not that simple, unfortunately. There's no free lunch. Use whatever cliche you want. Take this article as a starting point, look into Susan Goldhaber's work and look into some of the research, look at what CDC says. Their division that looks at toxic substances just comes out and says, you know, there's an association, there's no good data to link this to any kind of cancer, any kind of medical issue. Nevertheless, people are spending, billions of dollars to settle lawsuits. It's absurd.
And understand that there is motivation. There is financial motivation for activists and lawyers to pursue this. I mean, you've seen this with talcum powder. We talked about, you guys talked about this last week.
Yeah.
You've seen it with talcum powder. You've seen it with glyphosate. You've seen it with, you saw it with shunts, not shunts, but breast implants. That breast implants in the 90s were the big thing, right? Mm-hmm. And people were making a science-free allegation that they were associated with lupus, an autoimmune disorder. And what that led to is that babies were having a hard time getting shots to drain extra fluid from babies' heads who had a bad disease called hydrocephalus, because the companies didn't want to be liable for a science-free verdict. You saw this with talcum powder. You see this with all of this stuff. It's the same pattern over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And there are beneficiaries of that pattern.
That's right. It is an industry unto itself. And yep. That's truly disturbing, because industry should exist to make things that are helpful, not to yep. sue the pants off of different companies. And yep. anyways, all right, let's move on. That's a ridiculous story. This one is actually, I guess there's a good and a bad side to this one, Liza, but this is a story called Mushroom Hallucinogen Sales Booming Despite Reports of Serious Side Effects. This is by Sam Ogozalek, probably mispronounced that. Sorry, Sam, writing for the Genetic Literacy Project. And here he's talking about a marijuana dispensary in Florida that has been advertising fruit-flavored pot gummies and other products that contain tiny doses of chemicals from a mushroom. It's called Amanita muscaria, I believe is how you pronounce it. But yep. If you played the Mario video games, or if you've seen the Smurfs, this is the red and white mushroom that is so iconic. So the idea is you put a little bit of this mushroom in marijuana or whatever you're consuming, and it has beneficial effects psychologically. It's apparently, I mean, this is mostly anecdotal at this point, but people report feeling less anxiety, less stress. If they suffer from depression, their mood improves. But there are some nasty side effects, apparently. And Liza, again, you can talk more about this. And the reason it's supposed to be a good substitute, if you will, is because it's supposed to be milder than psilocybin, which is, I guess, is like the super double plus mushroom.
So, yeah, talk about all that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's this weird mix of where, like, you do have cases of truly serious side effects. You also have people reporting benefits, and you have the FDA, as they often are, sort of behind the curve, trying to figure out how they're going to regulate this, how they're going to do a risk assessment to figure out how much of this can safely be used, if any at all. And there we are. So take it away, yeah. Toxicologist.
Yeah. So this is really interesting. So recently in literature, people have started paying more attention to hallucinogenic compounds and their role in psychiatric disease. So there's been a renewed interest in different kinds of substances, LSD, for example. It's derived from lysergic acid, which is a naturally occurring compound that you find in ergot, which is a fungal infection of crops. Okay. And so when people in the Middle Ages ate infected rye, and this is a stable compound, so you could make it into bread, they would have what they called St. Anthony's fire, which was a disease that caused intense vasospasm, and they would lose their fingers and their toes and their legs and things like that. They'd have miscarriages, but they'd also have seizures and vivid hallucinations. In the 1930s, people realized that this particular extracts of ergot, well, from the Middle Ages on, midwives realized that you could help with postpartum hemorrhage. So one of the leading causes of maternal death worldwide they would use extract of ergot. And when they got better at biochemistry and everything, they discovered the active ingredients in those were responsible for decreasing bleeding after having a baby. And so that went on the market, and we now use a version of it called methyl ergonovine, so a synthetic version of ergonovine. In the meantime, so a Swiss chemist by the name of Albert Hofmann had a whole variety of these different, he was breaking down the different ingredients in ergot to see if there were any other therapeutic things that you could use it for. And he wound up synthesizing LSD, And so he put it on a shelf, and one day took it off the shelf and spilled some on his fingers and started feeling really funny and having a trip and all of this stuff. And he was like, ooh, I wonder what this is like. And the way a lot of people did things before the establishment of like the FDA and things like that and significant regulatory bodies was they would experiment on themselves. So he wound up calling a doctor over to his house and dropping 250 micrograms of LSD one day to see what would happen. he described what would happen, and the doctor thought he was like, at first he thought he got very panicked. He thought he was going to die and all of this stuff. And the doctor said, no, all his vital signs were normal. He has got very dilated pupils, but otherwise his exam is fine, physical exam. He's clearly hallucinating vividly. That launched the psychedelic movement, and there were a whole bunch of things that transpired, but long and short, and we could maybe talk about this some other time because it's really fascinating. But long and short is LSD got made a Schedule I drug, so you couldn't use it for any purposes whatsoever. Now, the other naturally occurring hallucinogen, there are several, but one of them is from magic mushrooms. And there is a whole spread in Life magazine from 1957, I want to say, where a guy by the name of J. Gordon Wasson, who was a vice president at J.P. Morgan, would go down to Mexico and trip on mushrooms, hallucinogenic mushrooms, with this tribe of people. And talked about how wonderful this experience was and stuff like that. So this was, you know, when the beatnik movement was going on and all the LSD experiments and, you know, hallucinogens, things, all that started happening. People were experimenting also with a chemical called, a concoction really called ayahuasca in the Amazon rainforest, which had similar effects. And they all talked about these classes of, naturally occurring chemicals as being entheogens, or you find the god from within, and they were used in shamanistic rituals and different tribes and stuff like that. Well, once again, LSD wound up being used experimentally on people in ways that they weren't expecting, and so they would have these terrible trips, and so it eventually got banned. So all of these categories of drugs were put on the back burner. So what happened? Fast forward. Well, we started understanding how things like depression worked. And depression is thought to have something to do with not having enough serotonin, which is your happy neurotransmitter, makes you feel good, in your central nervous system. And so people have been developing drugs that help modulate serotonin, and sometimes it's other neurotransmitters as well, but serotonin is really the major one that people talk about. So SSRIs, so selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they increase the amount of serotonin that's kind of flowing between the nerves, right? And so that seems to modulate mood well. When people started understanding how LSD and psilocybin worked pharmaceutically, they realized, wow, this is kind of interesting because it really modulates mood. This could really modulate mood. And they started revisiting the biochemistry and pharmacology of these compounds probably about 10, 15 years ago. And Hopkins did a study with terminal cancer patients who were profoundly depressed, and they had dropped some magic mushrooms and then reported a much better sense of mood. So that's the setting for this. Now, and Michael Pollan's just recently written a book about psychedelics and improving mood, and lots and lots of people have jumped onto that bandwagon. Now, you've got to be very careful with that bandwagon, because people with underlying psychosis can actually have very bad reactions with this. So you want to be you don't want to be just sort of tossing this out willy-nilly, and they are correct. This is the Wild West. Now, how about this particular mushroom? So psilocybin gives people vivid hallucinations and improvement in mood a lot of times. But now fly agaric, or this is Amanita muscaria, which is also fly agaric, fly agaric has been used for centuries as a insecticide. And they wind up, they would catch flies with these mushrooms and concentrate so they wouldn't have them around them. And remember, mushrooms, like plants, can't run away from you. All of these substances that I'm talking about are really naturally occurring chemicals that plants use to defend themselves from predation. So fly agaric was the same kind of thing. And it actually works on a chloride channel in insects, and it makes insects very snoozy and they fall asleep. So these are these sort of red mushrooms that will not really necessarily make you hallucinate the same way that psilocybin does. So what they have is they have something in it called ibotenic acid, which mimics an excitatory neurotransmitter, okay? And the excitatory neurotransmitter is glutamate. So if you think about it, we talked about this probably a couple episodes ago, where we're all on a spectrum between seizing and coma, and your brain has receptors and neurotransmitters in there that balance that so you're awake and alert. Mm-hmm. And glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. So if you have a lot of that floating around, you're alert. If you have too much of that floating around, you can have seizures and you can have twitchy muscles and stuff like that. So you want to make sure that you don't have too much of that. Ibotenic acid, which is in this, can cause seizures. And so you want to really be careful with the amount of this that you have. And I'm sure there is no regulation with these particular gummies that they're talking about or measuring of how much, what's the concentration from gummy bear versus it all the way to batch, which you have with pharmaceutical products, right? So ibotenic acid tends to make people seize in high doses. It gets metabolized, it gets decarboxylated to something called muscimol. Now, muscimol is very much like the other neurotransmitter, GABA, and GABA is the main inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain. So it winds up making you sleepy. So this particular mushroom kind of has a balance between ibotenic acid and muscimol. If you get one too much of one or the other, depending on the environment in which this mushroom grew up, you may be very, 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 very snoozy, and somnolent, which is maybe what people are talking about with relaxing, because it acts on that same receptor, the GABA A receptor. Ethanol, alcohol works on that receptor. Benzodiazepines work on that receptor. It's the rest and relax receptor in your brain. Or you may have seizures. Now, you can also have different concentrations of something called muscarin. And muscarin, you tend not to find a huge amount of it in this particular mushroom. But if you do get it in this mushroom and you get it in a high enough concentration, you can have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and a cholinergic kind of toxidrome, where you get very, very sludgy. So once again, these are the production of these mushrooms are not really well regulated. We don't know what the concentrations of these things are. We don't know if you actually have, who's picking these mushrooms? Is there any quality control? Are you getting the right mushrooms before they're being put in these things? And as you know, there are multiple very toxic Amanita species, not necessarily the red one, but there are toxic ones. So you want to be very careful about using mushrooms to, or any fungi, for example, to put in your candy that kids can get into.
Yes, of course. I think that's very important. It seems to me, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that the appropriate thing to do here, because the cat is out of the bag, so to speak. People have access to these. If you just simply outlaw it, it will go underground, just like with alcohol prohibition or any other drug, and people will get it. So maybe the approach here is to say, let's throw off the restraints on research and let scientists apply for grants and do the relevant kinds of studies. Let them do, long-term epidemiological studies. Let them do clinical trials. Figure out in what doses this is reasonably safe and the benefits and the risks. And then as long as people are made aware and they have access to a relatively low risk variety of, whatever product they're going to use, I think that that's probably okay. I mean, we let people drink alcohol. We let people smoke. Yeah. We let people go scuba diving deep under the water. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of, frankly. You know, but in other words, we let people take calculated risks. Most of us drive to and from work. We don't think twice, even though your risk of dying is significant, you know. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe that's a little too libertarian for some people, but it seems like a practical approach here. What do you think?
I think that's a very practical approach. Yes. Once again, the dose is a poison. We take risks every day. We put Botox in our face every day. Or lots of people do. And that's the most potent toxin known to mankind. And the reason why you can do that for cosmetic purposes is because there is a regulatory apparatus around it that tells you that if you use the right dose, it's not going to cause harm. So I think that the same approach to this, I think there's some really interesting research potential there. But I think that you do need to have some kind of standardized way of making sure that people are getting a safe dose.
Yeah, it seems to make perfect sense because there's a lot of chemicals, a lot of drugs that people use routinely. I mean, Botox is a great example, but opioids for pain control, you know, obviously those are harder and harder to get these days. That's a whole nother ferocious topic we need to get into one day. But you have doctors who will say, you know, this guy got his legs crushed in a car accident. I'm going to prescribe him opioids because he needs them. Or the drugs that we give young children for ADHD, you know, I mean, those are essentially amphetamines, but they're in controlled doses. They're prescribed by doctors. And again, another contentious issue, but there's a case to be made that there's a role for those depending on who they're being prescribed to. Maybe this is the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating research. It'll be fun to see where it goes.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be more stories. I'm sure there'll be some guy that will take way too much of this and go, I was on a trip for 5 years, man. You know, that's going to happen, I'm sure. Maybe it's already happened. Okay, let's move on here. Let's talk about this last story. This is a loaded question from NPR. What makes ultra-processed food so unhealthy? By Allison Aubrey. And she's interviewing a doctor. His name's Chris Van Tolleken. He's author of a book called Ultra Processed People. And I wasn't familiar with this gentleman, but apparently he's somewhat of a celebrity physician in the UK. He's done several programs for the BBC. He's kind of a science popularizer, as well as a credentialed academic who's done research. But the point of this book is to sort of elaborate on an experiment he did. I believe it was a 30-day experiment where he ate almost entirely processed foods. It's supersized me more or less, but he drank way more soda. He stopped eating, healthy brand based cereal and started eating sugary chocolate cereal that he loved as a kid, swapped out all the lean proteins and vegetables. And he started eating frozen lasagna and of course the predictable result of this is, let me read the quote here. He says, I became very unwell very quickly. I felt terrible. I stopped sleeping. I developed anxiety and became very unhappy. So his underlying thesis here, and again, I think this will be familiar to most people, but it's that ultra processed foods are loaded with sugar, salt, and fat, and they screw with your satiety and hunger signals in a way that actually makes you overeat, even though you are not hungry and that you don't need anything that you're eating. And of course, the result is obesity and metabolic syndrome and all these bad, bad things. And as a result, we need to regulate these foods, and shame on the food industry. That's the basic gist of it. Go ahead.
And that's the problem. So he essentially, in the section, the discussion, he's really sort of saying that the food industry is trying to make you addicted to food. That's the gist of it, is that they're stuffing all of this stuff in there on purpose so you won't be an addict and keep on coming back to their particular product. Well, you know, I think it is the part of the campaign against sugar. And I think that it's true that there is an increased risk of metabolic diseases if you eat too much sugar. I think that there is increased risk of obesity and things like that. But I think it's more complex than just only eating ultra-processed foods. I think that if you are in neighborhoods where you don't have access to grocery stores, And you don't have access to fruits and vegetables because fruits and vegetables don't have as long of a shelf life as some other things. I think that that can play a big role in the epidemic of diseases that we're seeing as well. But once again, dose makes a poison. Everything in moderation. I think that eating, at a McDonald's Happy Meal every once in a while is not going to hurt anybody. I think if you're drinking soda all day long, 24/7, then yes, you are at risk of metabolic syndrome and obesity. And I think that people know that. And I think that regulating things, I've seen a very interesting thing about McDonald's, and I have a warm spot in my heart for McDonald's. And the reason why I have a warm spot in my heart for McDonald's was not only were they in post-Soviet Poland in Warsaw, just shortly after the wall came down, but they had great food. And I had access to, you wouldn't find a lot of food in the shops at that time. You wouldn't have, a lot of, food there, right? There was food scarcity, and McDonald's actually was able to make the same quality food in Warsaw, Poland, as they did everywhere else. One, McDonald's also shows up in neighborhoods that no one else will show up to. They provide jobs for people. They provide quick, affordable meals for single moms who are, not able to go to the grocery store, buy all the ingredients, put it all together, and by the time the mom gets done with that, they've spent way more money than you do at McDonald's. And so I think that from a social justice point of view, McDonald's puts its money where its mouth is. It's in neighborhoods, provides that don't have access to anything else. It provides jobs for people in those neighborhoods. And it is a source of inexpensive food for at-risk moms. And I think that I'm not saying you should be eating McDonald's 24/7 and all of this stuff, but I think people forget all that. We privilege folks who are able to go to the grocery store in our neighborhoods underestimate how important that is.
Yes. Let me read this quote from Dr. Van Tulleken. And by the way, I'm going to be very critical of him. So I'd love to get him on the show. If anyone knows him or knows someone that knows him, let's get him on to talk about this.
Yeah.
But here's one thing that bugs me. And again, this sort of shows with due respect, the sort of food snobbery that really drives this ultra processed food is bad thing. So he says, processing is fine, meaning canning and pickling and right. You need processing to keep your food from spoiling and making you sick. Right. Yeah. So he says processing is fine, but ultra processing is where food is made in factories. It's wrapped in plastic. It has strange additives in it that you don't find in kitchens. And the purpose of the food is profit. All right. Look, doctor, everything is for profit. Nobody works for free. I just checked his book, the hardcover of his book, $23 on Amazon before tax and shipping. Right.
There you go.
Now he's not going to be a billionaire because he wrote a book, but he is making a profit off the book. I highly doubt that he does all his work for BBC for free. Everybody involved in a discussion like this, everybody everywhere goes to work for money because we need money to pay for stuff. And we want more of it than just what we need to survive. That's everyone, right? So we need to get rid of the silliness that it's like, oh, it's only the other guy that's greedy. Give me a break. Not buying it. Here's something else. There's a recent study. This was published in the Journal of Nutrition. And it's very interesting. They found that a diet containing 91% ultra-processed foods was actually far healthier than the typical American diet. So they took they took a bunch of processed foods and they based it on the Dietary Guidelines for America from the USDA, and they put together a diet that was perfectly nutritious, and they compared it to what the average American eats, and they said, this is ridiculous, right?
Right.
So in other words, you can eat plenty of processed food, or variety of processed foods, I should say, and you can still have a very nutritious diet.
You sure can.
Yes.
You sure can. And food processing, we may have talked about this several weeks ago too. Food processing it's a dirty word, quote unquote, but it actually liberates people from the kitchen, right? So you can go to work. So if you think about the story of the little red hen, right, who went and wanted to see if anybody would help her harvest the wheat, and they wouldn't come and help her with that. And then she would like ground up, milled it up. Nobody would help her with that. Then she wound up baking. Will anybody help me? Nope. And then everybody all of a sudden wanted to eat all the food. That's because she had gone and done all the parts of the food processing to make a loaf of bread. And all of food processing is helping people who have very busy lives be able to have access to food without having to grow it, harvest it, process it themselves, and then finally bake it. So that's what it is. And then the notion that food processing is associated with poor outcomes is not a valid association. Once again, it's really just don't eat too much sugar. Don't spend your whole life drinking too much soda. So that's the issue.
Yeah. Here's the conclusion. This is from the discussion section of that paper I just cited. They're talking about the NOVA classification system, and this is used by some scientists to identify the level of processing that a food undergoes. So they write, NOVA is not useful for determining the healthfulness of either individual foods or dietary patterns when current Dietary Guidelines for America recommendations are used as a context to indicate healthfulness. NOVA scores are not proxy markers for dietary quality. In other words, this whole ultra-processing thing it's nonsense. There is no correlation between the nutritional quality of your diet and the processing. It just doesn't exist.
And in terms of the plastic and in terms of the additives that he mentioned in there, the plastic there's a whole discussion about food waste. The plastic prevents the food from spoiling, and so do some of these additives. And these additives, once again, are tested before they're ever given and put in the general population to eat. So the additives aren't causing health effects, and the plastic's not causing health effects. The plastic is neutral. And if anything, it's actually protecting your health from microorganisms that can cause spoilage and make you sick.
Yes. I want to, this is sort of a personal note, but you know, it's important sometimes. So like I'm using a little app on my phone because I'm trying to, you know, my son's getting older. I want to make sure that my weight stays within a reasonable range. I use this app. I record what I eat. It's kind of irritating, but it's not that much work. And it's just a matter of like, okay, you know, based on what you weigh and your goals, here's how many carbs you should eat. Here's how much protein. Here's how many calories. It really comes down to that. It's just a little bit of personal responsibility. Stop blaming the food industry. I'm not getting paid to say that, by the way, just so everyone's clear. Yeah. Stop blaming the food industry. Stop blaming, you know, whatever boogeyman it is. If you're in the United States, you have a broad access to nutritious food. And, you know, we can get into the food desert thing another time. I just don't buy any of it. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, education is a part of it. Developing good habits at home is a part of it. It's not an easy problem to solve, but it is solvable. This whole thing that, like, the food industry is addicting you. No, they're not. Mm-hmm. Most food products fail. It's actually very, very difficult to develop a product that consumers want to buy. And I'm sorry I'm ranting. Think about this argument in a different context. You know, so if you buy a new car, and I've used this analogy before, I bought an SUV last year. It's the nicest car I've ever bought. It's like a mid-level Toyota. But you know, no one would say, those sons of bitches at Toyota, they put AC in the car, they put heated seats, they put a killer stereo system, they put a ton of legroom because they're trying to hook you on their highly advanced, ultra-processed cars when you could just ride a bike to work, right? Everybody inherently recognizes how stupid of an argument that is. But when it comes to food, we go, oh, the food industry wants to sell you food that you like. Yes, of course. Do you want them to sell stuff that doesn't taste good?
Well, there are some people who want everybody to eat bugs. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You first. All you bug advocates.
I know. That's exactly right. Ugh.
I want to, unless you have something to add there, I want to read another thing. This is from, I've mentioned this before, this is called the Duke Rice Diet. It was developed by a nutritionist, I believe his name's Walter Kempner, in the 1970s. This is a long paragraph, but this diet is utterly insane, okay? You could go to Duke University at the time and check into his clinic, and he would put you on this diet and a very intense exercise regimen, and this is what people ate. This is crazy. Okay. A patient takes an average of 250 to 300 grams of rice a day. All fruit juices and fruits are allowed with the exception of nuts, dates, avocados, and any dried or canned fruit or fruit derivatives to which substances other than white sugar have been added. Not more than one banana should be taken. White sugar and dextrose may be used. On an average, a patient takes about 100 grams daily, but if necessary, as much as 500 grams daily should be used. Tomato and vegetable juices are not allowed. Okay. If you were to ask any nutritionist or any dietitian today, just present this to them. Don't tell them where it's from. Say, what do you think of this diet? Every one of them would probably have a stroke. And if they recovered, they say, you can't eat this. But this worked. This is from the Archives of Internal Medicine, a major medical journal, 1975. Same guy publishing his results. He says, 106 massively obese patients who each lost at least 45 kilograms were treated as outpatients with the rice reduction diet, exercise and motivational enhancement under daily supervision. Average weight loss was 140 pounds. Okay. So look, I mean, it just goes to illustrate processing, whatever, you know, whatever magic diet, it's the carbs, it's vegan, it's bugs, it's Mediterranean. No, it's not. It's just a matter of eating what you need and not more. That's all there is to it. And that's, you know, this is the kind of stuff that broke me of my passionate advocacy for low carb diets. It's like, if people can eat 300 grams of rice today, a day, and lose weight, you know, people may not remember this, but Mark Howell, he's a nutrition professor at Kansas State, I believe. Back in 2010, he went on the Twinkie diet. He ate cookies and garbage, right? Food that most people would say is junk. He ate 2,000 calories of it. He lost 30 pounds. His metabolic markers improved. And then people said, well, you're a shill for Coca-Cola. He said, all right. So he reversed the diet. He ate a diet based on salads for a month, but he ate 3,000 calories a day, gained all the weight back.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And salads, salads are always promoted as like the thing to eat. And if you look at the actual number of calories in salads, woo, Nelly.
Excuse me. I ranted for so long, my throat got dry. So yeah, if anybody wants to come on and talk about this, I think it's sort of a pet peeve of mine because I was overweight as a kid and I lost weight. And so now I see people like promoting this stuff. You know, back when I was 14 and I was obese, this would not have been helpful, right? It's like, you know, you're beautiful at any size and it's McDonald's fault that you're overweight. It's like, no, it's not. Even at 14, I knew it was my fault, you know, for the most part. So just, yeah. Yeah, this is silly. It's a common thesis, but I just don't buy it.
Exactly. And yes, I once again, the dose makes poison. And so if you cut the calories, it'll come off.
Yes. Well said. It's not a sexy answer, but it's just the truth. You know, so many things, it's like, well, how do I earn money? Well, you have to save more than you spend. Well, how do I lose weight? Yeah. Well, you eat less than you burn, you know.
That's exactly right.
Right? How do I get a girlfriend? Well, you have to, you know, not be weird, right? You have to improve yourself. It's like, it's hard work. You know, life is hard work. It just is. I'm sorry, everybody.
It is. But I gotta say, I'm glad I'm alive in this day and age than I would have been, you know, 100, 200 years ago.
That's right. what was it? I forget the exact year. It was like right around the Industrial Revolution where life expectancy started to take off. And before then, right? No vaccines, no ultra-processed food.
1,800 people lived to 30. They died in childbirth. They died of insect-borne illness, infectious disease, you know, all sorts of stuff, malnutrition, all sorts of stuff that we sort of just kind of take for granted these days. And we romanticize, you know, and they didn't have ultra-processed foods and vaccines and any of that stuff that brought us a 30-year increase in life expectancy. 40 if you're 40 plus if you're from 1800.
Well said. Well said. Well, with that, I'm going to go eat some processed food and not think twice about it. And I will be here next week to talk about it and, you know, my harrowing experience with the sausage or whatever. until then, follow us on social media. It's at Dr. Liza MD. I'm at Cam J English. Genetic Literacy Project is at Genetic Literacy. Thank you so much. We've been getting some responses to the show. I really appreciate the feedback. If you have questions, if you have concerns, we will talk about them, which reminds me, we need to get to some of those next week. But follow us on social media. It's the best way to interact with us. Dr. Liza will answer your questions. I can't answer all of them because I'm not that smart, but she will. And with that, we will see you next week for episode 231. Have a great week, everybody.
Have a good weekend.